I think I'd like to discuss tonight is what's just been brought to my attention by one of our listeners, a person named Janet Phelan, who has sent me some information that I find so shocking and so pregnant with implication for all of us that I felt it important to air it. And that has to do with a journalist whose name is Susan Lindauer, who is now being held in indefinite detention at Carswell Federal Prison Medical Facility at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas. Now, there's a particular article about her situation that appeared in the Seattle newspaper, I think it's the Seattle Weekly, on March 24th, 2004, by Rick Anderson. The latest is from spy to psychotic, in quotes. The latest on the very strange story of Seattle journalist Susan Lindauer. Almost as instantly as she hit the global news cycle as an accused U.S. traitor, an alleged spy for Saddam Hussein's government, former Seattle newspaper journalist Susan Lindauer has dropped off the radar. Once the headlines faded in 2004, the public might have assumed she had been convicted and sent to a prison. But for the moment, Lindauer's strange story is incomplete. She is being held in a federal mental facility in Texas, never to get her day in court, according to officials and public records. Mostly unnoticed, a New York federal judge decided that she is incompetent to stand trial, and she is being held past a scheduled release date, which had been sometime this month, and forcibly medicated as part of her treatment. A former Seattle Post-Intelligence reporter and a former U.S. Senate and House aide, Lindauer, 43, was charged in 2004 with conspiring to act as a spy and of being an unregistered Iraqi agent. U.S. prosecutors allege that the anti-war activist accepted $10,000 from a group accused of being an Iraqi intelligence unit, and that she sought to support opposition groups after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. She insisted that her efforts were to get economic sanctions lifted against Iraq. She was not charged specifically with spying or espionage. The big question now is her sanity. She is being accused of mood springs and paranoid fears, people watching her. And as it turned out, federal agents indeed have been surveilling her and tapping her phone. She is supposed to have a history of mood swings, but people watching her have said that federal agents had indeed been engaged in continual surveillance. Two court-appointed doctors, according to a ruling last fall by U.S. District Judge Michael Mukasey, stated that the defendant is suffering from a psychotic disorder and mood disturbance that render her mentally incompetent and to the extent that she does not understand the consequences of the proceedings against her. Lindauer has been forced to undergo observation to determine if she will ever be allowed to defend herself in court, aided by an array of antipsychotic drugs. In other words, they are holding this woman incommunicado and drugging her, and then declaring her incompetent to even appear in court. Hold one moment, please.
Yep.
Friends say her mental state has worsened since her incarceration. It is entirely unclear when she will get out, said J.B. Fields, a federal employee who talks with her regularly. In a letter written to her second cousin, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card.
Her second cousin is Andrew Card?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Lindauer made no secret about her activism and her determination to aid Iraqi citizens. The letter, a copy of which she gave out, is one of at least two she sent to Card in 2001 and 2003. the undisclosed second letter mentioned an indictment being used to prosecute her. In the first letter, written on December 2, 2001, Lindauer indicates that she was working back channels of government in order to oppose the sanctions. She wrote Card about conversations she was having with Iraqi diplomats and extended an olive branch on behalf of Hussein's government in hopes of getting U.S. economic sanctions lifted against Baghdad. "I am truly praying, Andy," she wrote, "that this correspondence will trigger a response from you so that this ugly quagmire in Iraq can heal. Iraq is hoping for a reply through formal channels, but I am willing to carry any response." After his relative's arrest, Card refused to say whether he sparked an investigation of the journalist by turning over her correspondence to the FBI. The FBI would only acknowledge that Card had been interviewed as part of its probe. Lindauer is known also to prosecutors by the unexplained alias of Susan Symbol, who, when out on bail secured by her Maryland home in 2004, was immediately rearrested. She was awaiting trial last September when Judge Mukasey, after reading the assessment of court psychiatrists, determined that more observation was needed and ordered her to turn herself in to Carswell Federal Medical Center in Fort Worth, Texas. Lindauer's court-appointed public defender refuses to discuss the case. However, his firm sent an email to the concerned friends of Susan Lindauer stating, "Be assured that our office is working very hard on Susan's behalf." In fact, her supporters maintain that this public defender is doing virtually nothing. Now, the article in question goes on. Here you have a person who is literally being held incommunicado and subjected to drugging while incarcerated in a military institution.
Right.
Bridget Kelly, a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney Michael Garcia in New York, refused to comment. He did provide a copy of the September 26, 2005 court order in which Mukasey directed Lindauer to surrender at Carswell or face arrest. Unable to pay travel expenses, Lindauer was provided airfare from Baltimore to Fort Worth by the government. She was committed for a period not to exceed four months to determine if she has the capacity to permit a trial, the order states. "I got a call from her on February 4th, says Fields. "They are forcibly medicating her. She has women around her who cannot hold their own silverware to eat because of the extent of their medications. And she states that these treatments do not in any way make her fit for trial." It seems a lot like the ways the Soviets used to treat dissidents. This is the article. Lindauer told a friend that she was being treated like a terrorist at Carswell, and a relative of Lindauer who attempted to visit her was turned away. Fields says he supports Lindauer and is convinced that there is no evidence that could justify the charges against her. Lindauer was raised in Alaska and graduated from Smith College in Massachusetts in 1985 and worked as a reporter and is an editorial writer at the Herald in Everett, Seattle. She worked as a writer and researcher at U.S. News and World Report and Fortune magazines. Lindauer is the daughter of John Lindauer, a one-time newspaper publisher and former Republican nominee for governor of Alaska. In D.C., Susan Lindauer served as an aide to Representative Peter DelFazio and Representative Ron Wyden, who is now a senator, both from Oregon, in 1993 and 1994. She served as press secretary to Senator Carol Moseley Braun of Illinois, and she worked for Representative Zoe Lofgren of California. According to the federal indictment covering the years 1999 through 2004, Lindauer met with members of Saddam Hussein's intelligence services by meeting the delegations at the United Nations in New York. She returned from a 2002 trip to Iraq with money that the U.S. alleges was given to her by Iraqi agents. This was money that she was raising to oppose the sanctions. It was $5,000. In January 2003, prosecutors claimed Lindauer, as an unregistered foreign agent, delivered a second letter to the home of Andrew Card to make a case against invading Iraq, which was to take place two months later. The Justice Department characterized her letter as an unsuccessful attempt to influence United States policy, unquote. News reports and websites revealed that she had also written to Republican donors as well as to President-elect Bush. In contrast, the December 2001 letter from Lindauer to Card, a copy of which has now been posted on Field's website, is completely rational. She states that Iraqi leaders hope to demonstrate their good faith in creating the climate for talks with the United States and were willing to allow resumptions of weapons inspections. They also would cease firing on U.S. aircraft patrolling to the no-fly zone and would cooperate on issues per specific requests made by President Bush, she wrote. The information offered a potential foreign policy victory for Bush, she wrote, noting his praises would be sung in the Arab street, unquote. Iraq, she stated, has to accept its responsibilities, and then I'm trying very hard to help achieve that goal with the greatest hope that regional insecurities and instabilities of the Middle East may become diminished. Lindauer is in part accused of conspiring with Raed al-Anbouki and Wissam al-Anbouki, who are sons of an Iraqi liaison to the United Nations. The Anbukis are now charged with failing to register as foreign agents. They were employed at the UN. Lindauer said she is an activist, not a lobbyist. She was working to get U.S. economic sanctions lifted against Libya as well as Iraq because of their impact on the civilian population, she stated. Lindauer has long believed in the radical notion that Syrian agents and not the Libyan government were involved in the airliner bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland. Poor woman. While working as an aide to Wyden in 1994, she gave a sworn deposition to the commission probing the bombing. She told the investigators that she was under surveillance at the time and that her house was bugged. She also claimed that there were assassination attempts upon her. The article continues. Now, within 10 years, the government claims she had been functioning as a spy on the basis of her correspondence, some spy. She's writing to Andrew Card. She disclosed that she had been in contact with the Iraqis at the United Nations in her correspondence with Card, which she discussed openly with friends and with associates. Her friend Fields states that she saw herself more as a diplomat and an activist. I admire her for having the courage of her convictions in seeking to put an end to sanctions. Her philosophical approach was that she favored peaceful resolution and was horrified at the consequences that were befalling poor Iraqi citizens. She is pretty factual, unquote. This is the end of the story. I think what's remarkable about this is that here is somebody who can be snatched out of a living existence and an active existence, a professional existence, because she is engaged in political activity to oppose the sanctions in Iraq, is making her feelings known to Iraqi diplomats at the United Nations, is communicating, I think, somewhat naively with the associates to the Bushmen, out of the illusion that somehow they will be responsive to some sort of peaceful resolution of a conflict that, of course, U.S. imperialism has been designing for decades. But that is, of course, not the basic issue here. this is in 1984, this is the architecture of the fascist state,
yeah,
where someone like this can be brought into federal custody, put into a military institution, subjected to psychotropic drugs, and denied the normal presumption of innocence and due process, and assigned only to a public defender who refuses to object to the conditions that have been imposed upon her. And, you know, it's a sort of, we have discussed, Lenny, over the many months,
yeah,
the overarching nature of the repressive apparatus. But, I mean, here is, a,
yeah,
I think, a rather dramatic and compelling example of it. And I think, you know, it's an individual case, but one that it could be applied to anybody.
Yeah, it shows how much the United States has changed. Certainly,
I mean,
that couldn't have happened,
yeah,
in John Kennedy's United States.
Well, it's not so much even a question of John Kennedy as it is that the bourgeois judicial process within a very short time has moved from a point where such a situation would have been inconceivable to where it's routine. And it flows from the notion of enemy combatant. It flows from the whole panoply of events at Guantanamo Bay, at Abu Ghraib. It flows from the creation of detention centers where citizens who are called enemy combatants can be held incommunicado and without. And it flows from the Patriot Act itself, which has provisions that actually make it a crime to disclose if the authorities break into your house, take your possessions, or hold you, and even to let it be known is in turn a federal offense.
Yeah.
So the question here, as it's described by this rather conventional journalist, Rick Anderson, is if this can be done to Susan Lindauer, who, after all, from all we can see here from her, from the description of her, is a sincere but somewhat naive person whose political associations are with the established order for the most part. She's been advisor to Republican and Democratic figures in the House and in the Senate.
Uh-huh.
And she's a relative of Andrew Card, for her, which is obviously part of her misfortune. This is really, in my judgment, a rather terrifying insight into the practical meaning of this degeneration of the capitalist order and the nature of the state today.
Ralph, now let's move on. That certainly is an important thing to bring out, and hopefully she'll be able to get some resolution and get released. But did you want to go into the other subjects summing up the week?
Well, as I had mentioned, Lenny, the most recent information that we've been obtaining here is that the orchestration of the flu pandemic is proceeding apace.
Yeah.
And Bush has been issuing orders for which will allow for instant quarantine and forced quarantine on a national basis. Rumsfeld alone has made $5 million, by the way, just from the Tamiflu,
yes,
which is a drug that doesn't have to work. But that aside, I mean, the creation of the next pandemic is well in place. And every day we are being told that the the cases of the so-called avian bird flu are now appearing all over Europe, as they are in Africa and in Asia. So it's not a question of if, but when we see this occurring on a substantial scale across the United States.
I picked up a story on Cloak and Dagger just yesterday where one of the Russian officials came out and actually said that blamed the bird flu on being created by the Americans. They actually came out and said that.
That's exactly right. And he pointed to the mutation of the genome in the H5N1 virus, which has been disseminated, and he states categorically that this is an engineered undertaking. The evidence is massive for this. We had done a 6-part series called Creating the Next Pandemic, in which we had gone into that. And so I think one of the elements that we have to keep in mind is that in looking for the pretext or the justification for imposing the kind of martial law state that has been put into motion, it may be through the creation of the next pandemic. It may be through staging a 9/11-like event. But one way or another, these authorities are gearing up to create a situation that will allow them to put into play their detention centers and their mass roundups. And
now, Ralph, what about, do you want to say anything at all on the Milosevic murder?
Well, the Milosevic, I think we have to keep in mind, Lenny, with the breakup of Yugoslavia, that Yugoslavia had been targeted by U.S. imperialism over a period of time. And Milosevic in Serbia, like his counterparts in Croatia and in Bosnia and in Slovenia and in Kosovo, these were people who were formerly the heads of the Communist Party's apparatus, and in particular the secret services under Tito, and each in their respective states. But Yugoslavia was organized not along ethnic lines. The entire working class was organized across cross-ethnic and cross-republic trade unions. They were organized according to their trade and not according to their ethnicity. And the playing of the ethnic card, interestingly enough, was first put into play by the former heads of the intelligence services in Yugoslavia, who were bending to the will of the IMF. It's not unlike what occurred in with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the former KGB and Stalinist apparatus simply putting on their mafia hat and treating the public domain as their own corrupt playground for sequestering the spoils. Now, Milosevic in Serbia imposed the most draconian austerity measures on Yugoslav workers, affecting the state support for health care and for housing, for full-time work, for guaranteed contracts of work. All of the gains, if you like, of the Yugoslav Revolution, and indeed of the working class struggles over a period of more than a half century in the Balkans and in Yugoslavia. And the result of that in Serbia had been mass mobilizations by the trade unions and the workers against the Milosevic regime. Demonstrations because of its imposition of the World Bank and IMF dictates. It's at that point that the U.S. Special Forces went to Milosevic, as they did to the leader in Croatia, and they prepared for attacks by the Serbians on the Croatians and the Croatians on the Serbians, playing the ethnic card in order to divide the workers and to try to pit them against each other. These were not successful. The workers continued mobilizations as large as 1.5 million in Zagreb and in Belgrade. So the process through which the ethnic internecine conflict and ethnic cleansing unfolded in Yugoslavia was very much a device that at first all of the leaders of these republics, who were, the, as I mentioned, the former heads of the intelligence apparatus, now at the beck and call of the IMF, began to implement. It's only then that at a later point, when they were not successful in quelling the worker demonstrations, that the U.S. began this ploy of demonizing the Serbs, and in the process demonizing Milosevic himself. And in taking up the cause of the KLA in Kosovo, which was the KLA largely a drug smuggling apparatus that was created by the intelligence agencies, and interestingly enough, with respect to the Balkans and Yugoslavia, the Islamic fundamentalist CIA-sponsored and financed apparatus that included that of Osama bin Laden that they had put together in Afghanistan was now deployed in the Balkans and was very much an element in the KLA and in the internecine conflict and warfare that was unfolding, which the U.S. was using to break up Yugoslavia. The massive bombing required that they demonize Milosevic rather than they had demonized Saddam Hussein. And there are important parallels here because, as we've often discussed, Saddam Hussein has his origins as a CIA operative who was deployed after the Iraqi Revolution of 1958,
yeah,
which brought Abdul Karim Qasim to power as a nationalist officer, who then confined the U.S. oil companies to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq, and immediately he was targeted for assassination. And the man who was assigned that job was the young right-wing Ba'ath and CIA asset Saddam Hussein, who succeeded on behalf of the CIA in murdering Saddam on his third, murdering Abdul Karim Qasim on his third attempt. And much as he had been their man in Baghdad for 27 years, so Milosevic, in the aftermath of the death of Tito, was very much the vehicle, as was Tudjman in Croatia and Uzibegovic in Bosnia-Herzegovina. These were the what we call the nomenklatura, the Stalinist apparatus, the former Secret Service, the party heads with great privileges, highly autocratic, used the secret police to crush working-class opposition to the bureaucratic dictatorship of these Stalinist regimes. Now putting on their IMF hats, Milosevic in particular, they began to, as I mentioned, inflict the austerity measures and dismantling of the social gains of the Yugoslav revolution. Many on the left have sought to reinvent Milosevic as a kind of martyred victim of imperialism, and he certainly is that in the sense that they used him as a demonic figure in order to create a rationale for their project of decimating Yugoslavia, of destroying its cities by aerial bombardment, of unfolding the depleted uranium that has completely poisoned the soil and the aquifer throughout the region, and basically breaking the will of a highly politicized and radicalized working class in Yugoslavia. Again, a working class that was organized not on ethnic lines. They were intermarriages between ethnic and religious workers across the length and breadth of Yugoslavia. Croatian and Serbian families were totally intermixed. It required years of deliberate fomenting basically death squad operations that the U.S. orchestrated. I documented this in a long, almost a book-length series called Death and Devastation in the Balkans, a study of U.S. rule. And so now, with respect to Milosevic and his murder, without any question, it was clear that he was poisoned. In fact, the irony of the matter is that Milosevic himself had been warning that they were playing with his medications and that he was going to be killed and murdered.
Yeah.
And now they produced this doctor, the authorities have produced this doctor, to maintain that there was a strange leprosy medication in the bloodstream of Milosevic which was a medication that was completely counterindicated and was put his heart in great jeopardy. What's the explanation? He gave it to himself. He gave it to himself, they say, in order to create a basis for not being able to stand trial. So they murdered him. They did it by putting in a medication, feeding him a medication that gave him a heart attack,
right.
And then they blamed the victim, which is the standard procedure
for
imperialism. And indeed, Milosevic was like Saddam Hussein right now in the trial. Milosevic was exposing a great deal of what imperialism was doing in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Just as Saddam Hussein has used his trial to do the same, in which, for example, in the last 2 days, Saddam Hussein, in the courtroom, in the trial, drove the judges nuts when he stood up and he said that this is not a matter of crimes of which I am accused. He says it is the U.S. who is on trial here. The ethnic internecine fighting that is going on, the terrible destruction of the mosque in Samarra, the terrible retaliations against Sunni, the internecine bloodletting between Shia and Sunni, this is a design of the occupation, this is the crime of the occupation, and the judges were screaming at him that he's not to make political speeches. He said this whole trial is a political trial at the behest of your masters. And Saddam Hussein actually acquitted himself very, very powerfully and well, and I have to say that in his extremity, Milosevic was doing something similar in The Hague, and indeed Ramsey Clark was one of his defense attorneys, as he indeed has been for Saddam Hussein, and both these men, having been like Noriega before them, first used and then abused,
yeah,
were using the attempts to hold them up as the economic cause of the crisis in their respective countries, put their persecutors on trial in the process of their defense. But the uses that the U.S. has tried to make of Milosevic as a by fathering upon him crimes of which the United States was essentially the author, does not mean that that Milosevic's role in class terms and in terms of his relationship to the assaults upon the working class in Serbia and in Yugoslavia at large, in terms of the dismantling of the social ownership and the social gains in Yugoslavia. As I mentioned, the state support of health care, the state support of housing, support for public services, the guarantee of full-time work, the guarantee of worker involvement in decisions in the plant. All these things were being destroyed by Milosevic at the behest of the IMF, and it was the mass resistance of the workers to, not just in Serbia. There were huge demonstrations in Sarajevo, in Zagreb, in Croatia, in Ljubljana, in Slovenia, over these austerity measures, and the outright attack on the social achievements of the Yugoslav revolution. So the Stalinism aside, we have to understand clearly that the role of the Stalinist bureaucracy in these countries has been as to be essentially the handmaidens of a capitalist restoration. And once they're used in that way, then they're cast aside and abused when the imperialists start to have their way. And that's the underlying dynamic of the crisis in Yugoslavia and in the Balkans, which is in many ways a rehearsal for precisely what they are unfolding in the Arab East right now.
And where do you, let's see, what else happened this week? Certainly, we're waiting to see what's, as you say, Iran is heating up. I'm just wondering, do you see another 9/11 triggering
it? Targeting Iran. They've made it very clear that they're targeting Iran. And the question is posed. I think I should mention that the rather interesting article by Paul Craig Roberts, who was formerly a Reagan cabinet official, on the events that are taking place now with respect to Iran, he raises the question, why would Bush be willing to initiate an attack on Iran at this present moment? What is the logic of this, given the fact that Iran is three times the size of Iraq, three times the population, and the U.S. is obviously without the number, the troops that are requisite for carrying out this operation? In fact, I think it would actually be useful, because it's interesting to me that this man has a better grasp of the underlying dynamics here than many of the liberals and what passes for the left in looking at what's behind these policies and what the U.S. is really planning to do, because he points out that by looking casually or superficially at the circumstances here, it makes absolutely no sense for the Bush people to be targeting Iran at this point. It doesn't add up. The rationale for their doing this is hard to make sense of, because how are they going to pull it off? And what he points out is that what they're preparing for is something very different, not for a direct invasion, but rather for the nuking of Iran. And how are they going to pull that off? He writes, is another 9/11 in the works? If you were President George W. Bush, with all available U.S. troops tied down by the Iraqi resistance, if you were unable to control Iraq or political developments in the country, would you start a war with Iran? Yes, you would. Bush's determination to spread the Middle East conflict by striking at Iran does not make sense. First, Bush lacks the troops to do the job. If the U.S. military cannot successfully occupy Iraq, there is no way the U.S. can occupy Iran, three times the size and area and population. Secondly, Iran will respond to a conventional air attack with missiles targeted on American ships and bases and on oil facilities located throughout the Middle East. Third, Iran has human assets, including the Shiite majority in Iraq, that it can activate. Fourth, the polls of U.S. troops in Iraq indicate that a vast majority do not believe in this mission and wish to be withdrawn. Unlike the Yellow Ribbon folks at home, the troops are not enthusiastic about being trapped in an Iranian quagmire in addition to the Iraqi quagmire. And fifth, Bush's polls are down to 34%, actually it's 26%, with a majority of Americans believing that Bush's invasion of Iraq was a disaster. If you were being whipped in one fight, would you start a second fight with a bigger and stronger party? That's what Bush is doing.
Yeah.
Opinion polls indicate that the Bush regime has succeeded in its plan to make people fear Iran as the greatest threat America faces. The Bush regime has manufactured a dispute with Iran over that country's nuclear energy program and, of course, blocked every effort to resolve it. In order to obtain a pretext for attacking Iran, the Bush regime is using bribery and coercion in its efforts to have Iran referred to the UN Security Council for sanctions. In recent statements, President Bush and Pentagon Chief Rumsfeld blame Iran for the Iraqi resistance. claiming that the bombs used by the resistance are supplied by Iran. It's very obvious. Bush intends to attack Iran and will use any pretext to bring this war about. Yet Bush has no conventional means of waging war with Iran. His bloodthirsty neoconservatives have prepared plans for nuking Iran. By the way, the Paul Craig Roberts is writing as a former Reagan official, and interestingly enough, he visits all of this upon Bush when the Democratic Party has been to the right of Bush in pushing for an attack on Iran. That's been true of John Kerry, it was true of Barack Obama, it's been true of Hillary Clinton. This is not just Bush. But to continue with what Paul Craig Roberts writes, an unprovoked nuclear attack on Iran will leave the U.S. regarded as a pariah nation. Readers whose thinking runs ahead of most of us tell me that it is another 9/11 event that will allow the ground for a nuclear attack on Iran. Bush or Israel will provoke a second attack on the United States. Others have stated that Bush is working with black ops to orchestrate this attack. A low-yield tactical nuclear weapon may be exploded some distance out from a U.S. port. Death and destruction will be minimized, but fear and hysteria will be maximized. American citizens will be told that a ship bearing this weapon was discovered and intercepted just in time, and that Iraq is to blame. A powerful wave of fear and outrage will be orchestrated, and U.S. media will not report the rest of the world's understanding of what this explanation is really about.
Right.
Now, that, with its weaknesses notwithstanding, is a measure of how far we've come when Paul Craig Roberts, a Reagan official, has now grasped that 9/11 was a false flag operation, that they're prepared to stage another, and that their drumbeat for war with Iran cannot be in any way effectively implemented without something as horrendous as a tactical nuclear weapon. Otherwise, it doesn't make any military sense whatsoever. And even then, of course, the arrogance of a decadent imperialism is that they think that if they inflict devastation of this magnitude, that they will cow and intimidate, when in fact the more likely unfolding consequence will be the collapse of their client states throughout the region, the overwhelming of the Saudi monarchy, the collapse of Mubarak in Egypt, the elimination of Abdullah in Jordan. They are setting their foot on an inexorable path that is going to open up a revolutionary path, not only in the Middle East, but on a global scale.
Ralph, do you want to at all address the issue of Cheney and the 9/11 episode?
Well, yes, sure.
What you were talking about at the beginning of the
group called there's a group called I think it's called 9/11 scholars, with people like Philip Berg and Jim Fetzer, and Berg was one of those who, as I mentioned earlier, was a Cheney aide, and he is reporting that the people in the bunker with Cheney were reporting to him about the at intervals about how close the plane was getting to the Pentagon in Washington. They had it on the screen and they were monitoring it. They obviously were not intervening. They were standing down. They were not attempting to intercept it. They were not attempting to surround it with craft to down it. They were not attempting to shoot it down. But on the contrary, they were according to Philip Berg, on orders to let it continue
right
on its path. And this is being made public as a report by someone who was there of Cheney. Of course, Cheney is not alone in all of this, but Cheney in this instance is being pointed out as now, of course, we have all of us been involved in documenting on a much larger scale the role of the intelligence authorities with respect to all aspects of the events of 9/11, the fact that Mohammed Atta and his associates were trained at the U.S. military installations, that the airplanes that were supposedly hijacked were certainly not hijacked by these people, and they were actually not hijacked at all. That the taking down of the trade centers was an event that had nothing to do with their being struck by airplanes. That the prior knowledge of the events of 9/11 is something that every intelligence service in the world had reported, and much of the U.S. press has picked up on that. So what is being now pointed out about Cheney is simply what we say in U.S. football, it's called piling on. Yes, well, there's now yet another important piece of information that is to be added to the vast array of evidence that pertains to the false flag nature of the 9/11 events.
Yeah, it's shocking that that it's gone to this limit, and this so much has come out about this, and yet these people are still at the levers of power.
Well, yes, but then it's not because they enjoy vast support in the country. It's because there isn't an instrument of political change that has come together at this point in time. But that is continually try to develop on this in our talks, Lenny, is that is a song of the not so distant future. Because you cannot have an economic and political system so vastly unable to meet the elementary needs of people, and so clearly at war with the population at large, and see it sustained for any extended period of time. There's a certain threshold below which nothing significant seems to be occurring, and then suddenly a relatively small event. It's like, there's a threshold that's reached.
Right.
Triggers a response that can no longer be contained. I have seen this out of my own lived experience in many circumstances. During the Iranian Revolution, for example, I spent 8 months in Tehran and in Iran during the uprising against the Shah.
Yes.
And I watched how what started out as relatively small demonstrations, and they built and they built and they built, and now the troops were becoming indiscriminate in shooting people and in tear gassing them, and suddenly there came up a subtle threshold where, instead of intimidating people, every time people were gunned down in the streets, the demonstrations now multiplied by 10.
Right.
Every body that was carried away by people now brought mass demonstrations to the funeral. And now these rank-and-file soldiers began refusing to use their weapons. And then suddenly they started turning their weapons in the other direction.
Yeah.
That's a process that occurs as a regime's own standing and credibility begins suddenly
to crumble.
As was indicated by Paul Craig Roberts in his description of the state of mind of the rank-and-file soldiers in Iraq, that army, they're about to lose it, just the way they lost it in Vietnam.
Vietnam, yeah.
And they're sending home these youngsters, too, and their families are being profoundly affected by what they're hearing. And so this is a system in extremis, and the more adventurous it becomes and the more lunatic it behaves, the more it is digging its own grave. And deservedly so, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I think that, Ralph, before we go, I want to thank you for, as Sherman says, bringing your treasury of wisdom and knowledge to Cloak and Dagger. Just once again, fill us in on people. people can catch you. It's on our website, of course, but people can catch you on WBAI.org weekly.
Well, if they want to hear us live on Tuesday, and I, Lenny, I do intend to give much more precise detail about the pending avian flu pandemic. Maybe we'll do that on our next report. But we certainly will be addressing it on Taking Aim shortly.
Good.
And people could listen to us Eastern Time. It's Tuesdays at 5. If they have a software called Real Player, they can go to the call letters of the Pacifica station in New York, WBAI, which is www.wbai.org. And if they then go to live audio and streaming and put in listen, they can hear us right on the computer. On
yeah,
the
it's a great show. I listen to it every week, and I suggest all listeners can pick you up there and follow you. It's just a terrific show, and we look forward to having you back again next week, Ralph, to sum up and
thank you, Lenny.
Team us in on the developments this week. And thanks very much. Closing comment, Ralph?
Well, at this time I want to come back to what I started with,
yes.
Which is that I don't want to see... I want us to make sure that Susan Lindauer is
yeah.
not dropped down the memory hole and disappeared. And we need to build a campaign of support for her. She is an emblem of the psychotic and abusive state that we live in. And not that of it. It's not its victims who are psychotic, but the rulers and the so-called normal functionings of this society. We can't allow when we hear of these things and know of these things and document these things, we have to make sure they don't get away with this one.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure having you here, Ralph. We'll look forward to having you back again next week. Read it yourself instead of asking the government why, because that will cause the propaganda to die. Stay on the line, Ralph.
Okay.